Choose Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll learn all you need to know about gynecologic cancers. Plus, we'll meet some Upstate employees who are preparing for the Corporate Challenge Championship race in London. But first, should nurse practitioners be able to practice without a doctor's supervision? One of the many problems confronting healthcare today is the shortage of primary care physicians, especially in rural areas. And some fear that these shortages will worsen as more patients seek care under the Affordable Care Act. But some controversy has arisen as to just how nurse practitioners might help fill that shortage. We'll hear with more on this are Dr. David Duggan, Professor of Medicine and the Dean of Medicine, and Joyce Griffin Sobel, Dean and Professor for the College of Nursing, both from Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Duggan, we need more primary care in this country, and the demographic trends are suggesting we may need more. So tell us about this idea of nurse practitioners filling the gap. What's your thought?
Well, my thought is it's a very good idea. Our healthcare system is characterized by a lack of access for people at many levels. And this will provide greater access for people to get into the system. Once they're in the system and they're navigating with the aid of their nurse practitioner, their primary care doctor, or whoever it is that's guiding their care, I'm sure we can sort things out. But just having that point of first contact is extraordinarily important.
Why do you think it's become such a controversial issue?
Well, it's controversial. There are two basic arguments that have been set forth. One is the argument for, which I support, and that is that these are trained professionals. They understand what they are trained to do. They understand how to work in the system, when to refer patients for further care. And there's pretty good evidence that for many primary care issues, they perform just as well as physicians. The opposing argument is that their training has not been as long and has not been in as acute care settings like hospitals as physician training is, and therefore they may not be as comfortable or experienced in handling certain other more complicated issues. And I think that's where the major difference of opinion arises.
So help us, Joyce, help us understand then, in terms of training, we're talking about these opportunities for training. What is it that nurse practitioners do currently? How are they trained, and what can they do?
Mm-hmm. Well, nurse practitioners come in to a program usually with about 10 years of clinical experience as a registered nurse. So the education for the NP is built on that experience. People with lesser experience have a little bit harder time with the program. And then they receive an additional 500 hours minimum of clinical training with a variety of preceptors, some nurse practitioners, some physicians, so that they are able to treat patients across the full spectrum of the lifespan. Our program is based in primary care, but there are other nurse practitioner programs that are acute care, specialized in oncology, and different other specialties. The trend for the profession is that all nurse practitioners will have a DNP, which is a doctorate of nursing practice, and that is a clinical doctorate, similar to what physical therapists are doing, as well as now nurse anesthetists are moving this way too. Additional training, additional data analysis skills that they're able to really analyze the data to see what works and what doesn't work in terms of patient care. So the training is very rigorous. Very rigorous.
So when you talk about, you said preceptors in all kinds of areas, give us an example of the kinds of things they study or how that differs from their registered nurse training.
Mm-hmm. Well, the registered nurse training is a generalist training. Master's degrees and doctoral degrees in nursing are specialized. So our program, for instance, is a primary care. So our students have experience with OB. They have experience in pediatrics. They have experience in gastroenterology, let's say. They certainly work in a cardiology setting. So we really try and have them work with providers in a variety of settings and types of offices so that they see a good spectrum of the kind of patients they'll see in practice.
And are they being encouraged during this training to function independently in terms of decision-making, you know, and all of the things that would be required to take care of a patient independently.
Yes. Well, our education is competency-based, so, and that is the trend that all health profession education is moving towards, where it's not the length of the program, it's your ability to do. And a good example of that is, you know, you can read a recipe on how to make pie crust, let's say, for hours, but no matter how many times you read it, it really takes a certain number of tries before you can actually make an edible pie crust. Well, we don't really know what's the exact recipe for any provider, whether it's a nurse or a physician, to gain the skill needed to take care of patients. So we really work them through that process. So we level their education. In the beginning of their NP education, they are not independent. They work very closely with their preceptors and with their faculty. And by the time they finish the program, they are more and more independent so
that
they're ready
the goal.
For practice.
That
yes.
is the goal.
Yes.
What are their limits currently, though? I don't mean legally. I mean, mm-hmm. what would you say, or Dr. Duggan, what would you think of as a nurse practitioner if they were out there practicing independently, what limits would they have?
I think that really depends, just like it would for a physician, on what their training and experience is.
So it's very individual.
It's very individual. And if people have been working in a focused area for a long time, their skills may be equivalent to those of somebody else. I think the concerns that have been expressed are that they may not have had the same depth and breadth as a physician training does. But the key for anyone is to know their limits mm-hmm. and to know what is in the best interest of their patient and when their patient needs to get additional care.
And where to go for that.
And where
that.
To go mm-hmm. for that. And so we all work, we talk about teams, but it goes beyond teams to the system and knowing how to access the resources that are available to people when you can't deliver it all.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. David Duggan, Dean of Medicine, and Joyce Griffin Sobel. She's the Dean of the College of Nursing, and they're both from Upstate Medical University. We're talking about whether nurse practitioners should be able to practice without a doctor's supervision. Help us understand right now, what is the situation right now in New York State? I just say one other thing. I read that about a third of the states currently allow NPs, nurse practitioners, to practice completely without the supervision of a
that
doctor.
That is correct. And the movement across the country is that way. We had a major report that came out a couple of years ago from the Institute of Medicine looking at the future of nursing. And this was one of the top recommendations, is that nurses should be practicing to the full extent of their education. And so the FTC is actually issuing papers on it now. There's one that came out this month looking at some of the anti-competitive practices that have occurred in different parts of the country and advising states to be very, very cautious about limiting a nurse's scope of practice for that reason. So,
so right now in New York State, what can an NP do?
An NP can open her own office or his own office. She can work in, I'll use she just for ease of speech, she can work in a practice with physicians, which is what many of our graduates do. She is really able to handle whatever she feels capable and what she's certified to do. Our nurses have to be certified.
But what is all the rub then about independence? In other words, what is in place now that you're hoping to remove?
It's tradition.
No, but isn't there some kind of a legal requirement currently?
It's called a collaborative practice agreement, yes. And right now that requires an NP to have a signed contract, so to speak, with a physician or physicians to supervise. They can, in different ways, some of them do chart reviews. Some of them actually come into the office periodically. It is a financial agreement in most instances. And we believe it limits access to nurse practitioner services in the very areas that are needed for primary care.
So there's proposed, Dr. Duggan, there's proposed legislation right now in Albany to remove that collaborative agreement requirement.
Yes, and that's a proposal to remove the collaborative agreement in nurse practitioners that have been in practice for, I think it's 36 months, mm-hmm. is that right, Joyce? Mm-hmm. And that has created a great deal of controversy. I support that bill. Many other physicians do not, for the reasons I think I've outlined. And I think that there is there's an overlay of the business and contractual issues that Joyce outlined as well.
So you think that some of this is a turf issue, perhaps financially driven?
I think that some of it is. I also think there are some people that have very sincere concerns about the quality of care. But the evidence that I've seen to date is that the quality of care is the same. And all physicians, all nurses that might be caring for patients, wherever they're practicing, need to understand the system in their area and be able to access help when they need it. I cannot do surgery. I need to be able to call a surgeon when my patient needs surgery. I am not expert in every aspect of medicine, and I need to call on consultants all the time. A good nurse practitioner should be able to do the same thing when they don't feel that they have a full awareness of what their patient's problem is and they might need some extra help.
So in fact, Joyce, there is no evidence at this point that the outcomes differ. In fact, to the contrary.
No, there have been a number of reviews of the literature that demonstrate that patient outcomes are the same between nurse practitioners and primary care physicians. And there are other studies that show that nurse practitioner outcomes are better in terms of patient follow-up and patient satisfaction. They get the time, they get the emphasis on their entire lifestyle and how their illness affects their entire lifestyle as well as their family. And that is the nursing perspective that many patients enjoy.
So how would the current situation actually change? If the law went through, the only difference would be that they would no longer have to have any contractual relationship with a physician. Is mm-hmm. that correct?
Yes.
They could practice, as you said, set up shop anywhere mm-hmm. and do their and be licensed mm-hmm. to follow through and function completely
yes.
independently. If Upstate has a training program right now for nurse practitioners, would that change if this came to be?
Well, we are changing our program in order to make sure that they are prepared for taking care of patients in this current healthcare reform environment. So yes, that will be part of it.
Well, very interesting. Obviously, it's going to be resolved sometime, although I don't know with Albany the way it works, it might be a long time from now. But I appreciate you both coming in and you know, illuminating us on all of these issues. Very, very interesting. My guests have been Dr. David Duggan, Professor of Medicine and the Dean of Medicine, and Joyce Griffin Sobel, Dean and Professor for the College of Nursing at Upstate Medical University. Next, what you need to know about gynecologic cancers and their treatments. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. More than 83,000 women were diagnosed with gynecologic cancer in the United States in 2010, and almost 29,000 died from it. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Rinki Agarwal. She's assistant professor in gynecologic oncology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. How are you, doctor?
Good, Linda, and thank you for having me here.
Let's begin by helping us all understand, what do we mean when we say gynecologic cancer?
We essentially mean cancers of the female genital tract. So we're talking about cancers of the vulva, vagina, the cervix, the uterus, ovaries, peritoneum. And we also include other female cancers that affect these organs when we generally think about it, because we end up helping in managing those patients.
So basically, it's the whole female genital urinary tract. Not the urinary tract, the genital tract.
The genital tract.
Right. So obviously, each cancer is going to be somewhat different based on where it's located, but how in fact do they differ?
They're completely different in their presentation, in what organ is affected, and also how we manage and think about them. So a vulvar cancer, for example, if we're going to start from the bottom and work our way up, is a cancer which is essentially of the skin. So it's like a skin cancer, but it's also different in that we understand and we think that it's a slightly different presentation than other skin cancers in the rest of the body, and we treat it specific to the location that it has. So that's vulvar cancers. Those can be HPV related. HPV is a virus that...
human papillomavirus.
Is the human papillomavirus, thank you, which is sexually or otherwise transmitted and present in where the vast majority of the population is exposed to it at some point or another in their lifetime. The vast majority of people will clear it, and some people won't. And when it sticks around, it can affect the vulva, the vagina, as well as the cervix, and we see cancers related to that from HPV.
So there's been an increased incidence in that in recent years?
There's actually been a decreased incidence in some cancers. Mm-hmm. We'll touch on the cervix cancers in when we talk about that a little bit. But for vulvar cancers, that's also been associated with the HPV infection. And it's more commonly seen in older, in our senior population.
The vulvar cancer.
The vulvar cancer.
So let me get this straight. The vulvar cancer is called that because it takes place in that anatomical region.
That's correct.
But the cause of it or the type of cancer cell is more like a skin cancer.
Well, it is a skin cancer, but it is this viral cancer that we don't... Generally, skin cancers are not due to exposure to a particular virus, but this one
with the
is
HPV.
Or can be.
Right. But how about the others, like when we talk about ovarian or cervical cancer or uterine cancer, do they have different cell types involving them?
They do, and they are all completely different and get... thought about and treated in completely different ways.
So the only
So
the only thing in common that they have in terms of a category is that they all take place within the woman's reproductive tract.
That's correct.
And so we call them by their location, but in fact, each one is unique or uniquely
they are
different.
Very unique in their biology. So we started to allude to cervical cancers. Those are also HPV-driven cancers. The vast majority of them have the HPV virus detectable, if you were to test for it, in the cancer. And the cervix anatomically is, so in the body, is a extension of the uterus. If you were just looking at it, you may not be able to see a distinction, but that's the lowermost portion of the uterus. That is what you get looked at and tested when you have a pap smear annually. And... that cancer incidence was very high probably earlier in the 1900s. And then with the development of what's called the Pap test or Papanicolaou test, the incidence reduced dramatically
because
of better screening.
Ah, was found
very
earlier.
Very effective screening. Mm-hmm. We've come to kind of a standstill in our improvement and reduction in rate of the cancer because I think we're catching the cancers we would catch with the Pap test. And there's some conversation now of how you can improve on that. And that solution is probably going to present itself in a multitude of ways, which is to improve the test, maybe add another test in the form of the HPV DNA testing. The FDA has actually approved now the HPV DNA test for primary testing, so instead of the Pap smear. And then the other is really to have more consistent screening. So the patients I see more commonly with cervical cancer are people who've missed that Pap test, that have had issues with following up with physicians for lack of care, inability to access care, or other social reasons.
How about ovarian? And isn't ovarian at this point the most deadly?
Yes. If you think about ovary cancer, it is generally thought of as being a higher mortality cancer. So people will die from that disease if it's found. And it's certainly presented in the media in that sense. It's an interesting cancer in that it responds extremely well to treatment. So it's a responsive cancer. You typically find it at an advanced stage because the findings that suggest the cancer are so subtle. I hope we have a chance to discuss that. But tends to be that once it is found, it is treated with a combination of surgery and chemotherapy and responds very well to treatment. So that rate of response approaches over 70%.
So why is it considered so deadly if it's responsive?
Because it tends to come back. So when we say response, that's that initial response, people getting better. And then in the time following, which could be in the range of months to several years, a number of people will have the cancer come back.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Rinki Agarwal, and we're talking about gynecological cancers. So what about uterine cancer? Is that equally deadly, or is that also responsive?
In fact, that is not. And probably that's related more to the stage that we find the cancer in. So uterine cancers are also called endometrial cancers. That's cancers of the lining of the uterus. That's what women typically menstruate from. And it's a cancer conversion of that lining of the uterus that we're talking about. Presents early because people have vaginal bleeding or abnormal discharge in a postmenopausal setting. So they've already stopped menstruating and then they're having some bleeding. And it comes to the attention of the gynecologist. They get a biopsy. It's a very easily accessible part of the body for a biopsy. And when we find it, it's typically stage one. So when they have treatment, the vast majority of people are found at an early stage and they do well.
So early detection is very important for all of these cancers. Let me get a sense of what are the symptoms, because they're different. I don't want to run out of time, and this is really important. How does someone suspect or know they might have any of these cancers? What are they looking for?
Differs on the bit depending on what part of the body you're dealing with. But with cervical cancer, you'd have bleeding, spotting, intermittent, in-between bleeding, in-between periods bleeding, bleeding with intercourse. With uterine cancers, typically because it is a postmenopausal cancer, it's bleeding or discharge after menopause. And it is seen in younger women where then they would have irregular periods or heavy bleeding. And with ovary cancer, we call it the silent disease because it's extremely subtle in its presentation. It fakes people out because it causes bloating, distension, increase in the abdominal size, legs swelling. People so aren't able to eat well. So
those are more subtle, and like you said, they could be caused by any number of other problems, not even diseases.
Right. So patients and doctors get faked out because those symptoms are so generic, and anybody could go through them at some point in their life. It's hard to find it.
You alluded to the screening devices. Right now, the main screening devices are really for cervical cancer. Is that correct?
And that's the most
PAP
effective.
And the HPV screening.
Correct. So those are what we're using for cervical cancer. Again, the gaps where we are missing cancers is because people have lack of follow-up.
Who in general is most at risk for these kinds of cancers? I mean, can you make a category of people? Is it age-related? Is it genetically determined? I mean, who's most at risk?
It is age-related to some degree, but pretty much anybody is at risk for the cancer. We do think of certain things to stratify people into a risk level. So for ovary cancer, that would be a strong family history of cancers. Ovary cancer in first-degree relatives, so that would be a mom or a sister. And then beyond that, it's a strong family history of ovary or breast cancer, even in relatives who are further removed from the patient.
Is that related to the BRCA gene? In other words,
that would be partly related. One of the genes that contributes to ovary cancer risk is the BRCA genes. Mm-hmm. But now we found a number of others that have probably not the same size effect. In other words, if you had the gene, the likelihood of developing cancer is probably highest in the BRCA genes. But these others also contribute to the risk to a smaller degree.
So if there's any family history, you should be on the lookout or at least be aware that you might be someone who could develop ovarian cancer.
Right. And it's not to keep it internally, but to actually talk to a physician, because that's going to be key to early detection.
I don't want to go ahead.
I'm sorry. I advocate for people to come in and have a conversation and actually consider risk-reducing surgery because it's so important, and we don't have good screening techniques for ovary cancer.
Yeah, there have been some very high-profile people who are electing to do that kind of surgery because they have a family history. I think Angelina Jolie recently has been talking about perhaps getting a full hysterectomy because of her mother's death from ovarian cancer. So clearly that is of great concern. But these other cancers, I hear what you're saying is that there could be some kind of symptoms that were not really clear. So in every case, if you have any of this vaginal bleeding, which is unexpected, or some pain, you should basically check with your doctor and make sure what's going on.
Absolutely. And that may help you find it early.
Very briefly, treatments. Are we mostly doing surgeries and chemotherapy and radiation? Can you just very briefly tell us?
So overall, those are the modalities that you would use, surgery and chemotherapy and radiation in specific cancers. And what we do and how we choose it is dependent on the findings and the extent or the stage of the cancer.
So those are really going to be on an individual basis in terms of what choices are being made. And currently, aren't they trying to do things that are more minimally invasive? So they don't do large surgeries. They do things laparoscopically or in a less...
We're doing a lot of our surgeries with the laparoscope using robotic technology now.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. Perhaps we'll come back another time. We'll talk more about the treatment modalities. Thanks
again. Appreciate
your
time.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. My guest has been Dr. Rinki Agarwal. She's assistant professor in gynecologic oncology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Blink 10, blink 20, blink 32, or picture my life? Well, folks, the first thing you'd see coming into my office was part of a desk and paper piles tilted, crashed, swirling atop the barely can be seen gray formica, and big swirly white splotches with some order, more disorder everywhere across the bluish-greenish carpet, like chunks of something hurtling somewhere after the Big Bang. Yes, my office could be described as messy, capital M, but someone recently described it as cozy, too. And after a long time thinking and committing and talking about a major league cleanup pickup coming soon, I came in Sunday, wheeled in the gargantuan industrial-size recycling bin, and launched. Near the top of a relatively new pile, teetering on the far left edge of the desk extension, a certificate. Congratulations on your 30 years of dedicated service to Upstate. Wow. In this office 30 years. And this certificate in this pile almost too. A saver? Nah. Into the bin. Ah. Moving left to right across the piles. 4 hours later, I'm digging down the geological strata of my career, scanning, sorting, tossing another certificate. Congratulations on your 20 years of service to Upstate. In that pile, 12 years. Now, some people would unkindly call me a pack rat or would give me a neat but nasty diagnostic category label like hoarder. But that isn't me. Neatness counts, but just hasn't been high on my list. What's been higher? My wife and I making our house, making the kids, cooing and cuddling and changing the diapers, the PTO and homework, the kids' soccer, cross-country, lacrosse, baseball, are all of us running, designing, building and painting the clubhouse behind the garage, SATs, college visits, tearful graduations, joyful parents' weekends. And sure, my work, our work, and the papers and piles have been the lingering snowfall of this often very gratifying work life. the archives of this published paper and that big presentation, this client or colleague or student or couple or group. But cool, here's the picture taken by Pammy, a.k.a. Mommy, of me and the boys, us proud, exhausted construction workers in the doorway of the just-finished clubhouse that was planned to take one weekend but took 10 or 20 or maybe 32. Who knows or cares? And here's the picture of our wild youngins that hot, hot, hot day when it suddenly thunderboomed and poured and they exploded out the back door into the full, drenching, head tilted, mouth open, drinking wet of it, and jumped and splashed and danced, laughing and squealing and shouting, then gasping and grinning gargantually, stilled for a split moment, beaming up for me at the top of the stairs. I can still see us all. Smile. Now, those are keepers. Moral of the story? Filing less and piling quick to play more was sunshower brilliant for me and us. Let's not apologize for our swirling order disorder. Only accept enough shame to stay out of jail. Swim mightily in the ticking by time drops of our lives because papers get recycled, but love flows forever. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, what it's like to prepare for the Corporate Challenge Championship foot race in London. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, with your Healthy Monday Minute for March 31st. Take a veggie vacation. Traditional cultures around the world have long known the benefits of a mostly vegetarian diet. Numerous studies have linked vegetarian eating to lower cholesterol, blood pressure, and overall weight, as well as a decreased risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and certain cancers. A healthy vegetarian diet consists of mostly whole, unprocessed fruits, vegetables, grains, nuts, and beans. Take a world tour and improve your health this week by sampling some traditional vegetarian dishes. You can easily find these recipes for Indian, Mediterranean, Asian, and other meatless cuisine on websites like www.meatlessmonday.com. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Each year, employees from Upstate Medical University are encouraged to represent Upstate and participate in the J.P. Morgan Chase's Corporate Challenge. It's a 3.5-mile road race intended to promote fitness in the workplace and camaraderie and to benefit a local charity. Well, here with us to tell us about some exciting news about their experience with the Corporate Challenge are Kristen Kamak. She's an exercise specialist with the Vitality Program at Upstate Medical University. That's part of the Institute for Human Performance. And Chris Laughlin, he is a computer systems administrator also for Upstate. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So you guys have some very exciting news to share. Chris, tell us what you're going to London. Tell us about it.
Our mixed team, won the Syracuse Corporate Challenge, and the winner of each Corporate Challenge site around the globe actually gets to go to the championships, which are being held in London this July.
That's amazing. You must be very proud of yourselves and very excited.
Absolutely. It is. It's very exciting.
So help us all understand a little bit more about this thing. This Corporate Challenge is run, as you said, around the world. I mean, I read somewhere that it's taking place in 7 countries or on 5 continents, and we had one here in Syracuse. And you guys finished in the top of that and basically qualified to go to this championship.
Correct. Is that correct?
Yes. So JP Morgan Chase, this is their corporate challenge. So they run this, as you said, in different countries. And just local employers from that city and each of these cities, they send a bunch of their athletes to the event. And then they all get together as a group and the starting gun goes off and everybody runs. And then at the end, each employer can calculate their best athletes' times and try to figure out if they have a qualifying team for the championship. They submit it, and then those results are tallied, and they choose. Each site chooses a mixed team, which is made up of two men and two women, which is what we are on, men's team and a women's team, so four women and then four men. So there's three employers from upstate New York that are sending teams to London this year.
Wow. Is that unusual to have that many people competing from upstate New York?
No, it's every single year upstate New York sends three teams to a corporate challenge championship.
Very impressive. So, Kristen, tell me, you've never been to London, I imagine, right?
I have never been to London, no.
What do you think about this opportunity?
I'm really excited. I actually went to Dublin, Ireland back in 2008 and ran a marathon there. But that was kind of something I did on my own. So this is an exciting opportunity to be able to do it as a team with my coworkers from upstate.
You have two other people on your team?
We do.
And they are?
Yes, John Cole is the other male member of our team, and Kara Leverry is the female member of our team.
And so just help us understand again, you guys went out and ran in this corporate challenge, and you ran as individuals. I mean, you were part of the upstate group, but then you basically qualified for this based on your times, and then you were put together in this mixed team, right?
Correct.
So when you go to London and you run the race, you once again are running as individuals, am I right?
Yes. Correct.
And then at the end, they kind of calculate whether your team made it, so to speak, or how well your team did?
Yeah, I think our mixed team will go up against the other, however many cities you said total, they all have mixed teams as well, so that they'll take the sum of the four of our times and get a total number, and then the same for all the other teams, and whoever's the fastest, you know, the lowest number will win the Corporate Challenge Championship mixed team division. And then I think they actually go on after that to, there might be another bigger event later on, but they'll do the same thing for all the men's groups and the women's groups as well. So the championship that we run in London will be the event that happens first, and then London will just have their normal corporate challenge.
How
race.
Did you guys? I'll just start with you, Chris. How did you get into running?
I
or
got
at least
into
competitive running.
Yeah, I got into running in general. It was like 7 years ago. I just had my first kid. My daughter was born, and I was much heavier than I am now. I was like 65 pounds heavier than what I am.
Wow.
And yeah, so my daughter started to become mobile, and I found I was losing my breath, keeping up with her, climbing upstairs and stuff like that. And I was finally decided I needed to get in better shape. And I'm from the Utica, the Mohawk Valley area, growing up. So the Boilermaker was always, that race was always like just a part of my consciousness. I'm like, that'd be so cool to run. And that, so I decided at that point I was going to get healthier, and I started eating better, and I started doing running in the gym, and I found that I really liked it, and I got outside, and I just like became addicted to it almost right away. And so that first year I ran, I don't know, like five or six races, and then trained all winter long, and then started running longer and longer distances.
Like Forrest Gump.
Yeah, like Forrest Gump. You know, I kept going, building up, and I never thought I could do like the 9 miles that, you know, the 9.3 that's the Boilermaker, and I ended up doing that and beyond. I've done, you know, 9 marathons and ultra marathon ever since.
Oh my goodness. That's quite
a great journey.
Incredible. That is quite a journey. How about you, Kristen? You said you ran one marathon. Tell us about your background.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in running?
I started running when I was in middle school. I would say I'm not very much of an athletic person, so running kind of came naturally to me. It doesn't involve a lot of athletic skill, just kind of putting one foot in front of the other.
It's one way to look at it, but most people think of runners as athletes.
Right. And I actually ran my first marathon when I was a freshman in college, and have just kind of stuck with it. It's something that, you know, provides some mental relief for me, just can be stress relief, and then also the physical challenge of being able to push myself and see how far and how fast I can go.
If you're just joining us or listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, I'm Linda Cohen here with Kristen Kamak and Chris Laughlin, who are preparing to go to London to participate in the corporate challenge there, which is a road race coming up in the summer, and hoping to really do well, I think. So what are you guys doing now to get ready? Chris, first you. What are you doing?
I have multiple events on my calendar coming up that I'm preparing for. I'm actually right now I'm preparing for another marathon. I do Buffalo marathon pretty much every year. So I'm trying to work up my distance in this cold weather, trying to get in a lot of long runs and to build for that. I'm also doing the Ironman 70.3 in Syracuse triathlon. So I'm kind of trying to get some swimming and cycling in as well. So I'm kind of doing all that, balancing all that out and trying to get ready for those events, and then hoping that the speed comes as I get more acclimated here during the season.
Plus working and having a family.
Plus, yes.
Pretty amazing. And also taking on other sports like swimming.
Yes.
And bicycling, because yeah. That's a triathlon,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I had to learn how to swim pretty much this year. I mean, I did one last year, and it was not a pretty sight, me trying to finish the event in the water and having everybody else pass me. So I've been taking some lessons and doing that and really working on that this
year.
That's
a great goal, though. It's a great goal. What does it do for you? I mean, just briefly, I mean, Kristen was talking about that it has some stress relief for you, but what does the running do for you or participating in any of these races? What does it do for you?
I mean, stress relief is definitely part of it. I like to get out. I do a lot of my runs during my lunch breaks, and I like to get out and just clear my head and then focus on any problems that may be cropped up during the day. I've solved a lot of technical issues just by being out there running and just having a clear head, and then like something will come to me that I couldn't think of at my desk because, you know, there's so many other things going on. So it's really great for just clearing the mind and getting me, you know, prepared to face the afternoon, gets my energy levels up.
How about you, Kristen? What are you doing to get ready?
I would say right now my approach is probably opposite of Chris's. My last race that I focused on was a marathon back in November. So now I'm thinking about cutting back on my mileage and hopefully working on developing some more leg speed for the shorter race in London, since it's only 3.5 miles.
Does that usually follow, though? In other words, if you're a longer distance runner, your speed is not as good as if you kind of focus on the shorter distance and the bursts?
I would say not necessarily, probably in my case, because the longer I go, probably the slower I go. So just trying to get through the winter, looking forward to spring, shorter workouts on the treadmill, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys think you'll do in London when you get there, besides the race?
Yeah, I've never been, and it's one of my dream cities to visit. So I'm really looking forward to just seeing everything, to seeing I'm a big soccer fan, English Premier League soccer fan, so I'm looking forward to seeing some of the stadiums.
Will you have time to attend games, you think?
Or? I'm not sure or not. I'm planning on going out there. We're going to arrive on Sunday, and we're staying through until Friday, so we'll see what we have time for. The Corporate Challenge has events around. There's like a welcome ceremony, and then there's a post-race event, so there's some things going on, I think, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of that week, and hopefully do some sightseeing around that.
That sounds very exciting. So I understand you guys are paying your own way. So, but there is some support.
Yeah, actually, the Corporate Challenge, they pay. JP Morgan pays our flight tickets. And hotel rooms, two hotel rooms for our team, and then anything above and beyond that. If we want to bring family, I'm bringing my wife with me, so we'll have to get a room for her and her ticket as well, and then tickets to the events that JP Morgan Chase is putting on.
Sounds like a real wonderful opportunity, though, for a little bit of a life experience, family,
yeah, it really
travel.
Is.
How about you, Kristen?
I actually have a big contingency going with me, a lot of people who are really excited and supportive. So I'm going with my husband, my mom, one of my three brothers, and one of my aunts.
Oh, my goodness. You'll have
to travel to London to cheer me on for the 3.5 miles.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That'll be really exciting for the whole family. That's wonderful. I hope, you know, you'll come back maybe and tell us how you did and what happened when this is all over. Do you know if there are prizes attached to any of this? I was always curious about that.
Well, for winning the local mixed team, we actually got trophies, really nice crystal trophies. I'm not sure what the prizes or what the trophy is for the championships.
What would you tell people if you were going to tell them, you know, to inspire them to do this kind of thing? I mean, what I know that part of the goal of this whole corporate challenge was to kind of promote fitness in the workplace, but also camaraderie. Did you have that experience, or is this the first race that you've run?
I actually ran the corporate challenge previously for my previous employer before coming to Upstate. This was my first year running for Upstate. And I think running is a big personal endeavor. So it's something that, you know, it's an individual thing. You go out, you compete against yourself. I mean, certainly there's moments where you look to place overall, but I think that that's what's unique about the corporate challenge is that it's a team event. So we really are all backing each other and supporting each other through the training and through the trip to London, which is really unique that you don't see in a lot of races that it's a team thing, whereas this one really is with the four of us.
And you think that really changes the experience for you?
I think so. I do a lot of local races, and I've actually, our other teammate there, John, I've seen him in a bunch of events this year, and just, like, I didn't know him before the Corporate Challenge, and now I do, and we're very close in pace to each other, so we have, like, each other to push on.
We have each other's back.
Yep. And also to kind of be, you know, competitive against one another as well. I mean, I think in the Corporate Challenge, I only beat him by, like, 7 or 11 seconds, so, and then he's beaten me a few times this season, so it's great to have that, and to somebody that I wouldn't know otherwise to have out there and be able to compete with and be friendly with. It's great.
Well, I want to wish you all the very best of luck. And Nick, as I said before, maybe you'll come back and tell us how you did. We'd love to hear. And I hope you have a really wonderful experience in London from every standpoint. London's a beautiful city, and I'm sure you will have a whether you win the race or not, I'm sure you're going to have a wonderful, wonderful time.
Thanks so much. Thank
you. My guests have been Kristen Kamak. She's an exercise specialist with the Vitality Program in the Institute for Human Performance at Upstate Medical University. And Chris Laughlin, he's a computer systems analyst for Upstate University as well, Medical University as well. Thanks again for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. We live in the age of modern miracles in medicine, and we justly celebrate the technological discoveries and marvels that can keep us alive. But what's it like living with such technology? Emily Klein, a marketing consultant from New Jersey, now stays at home full-time to care for her daughter with special needs. Her essay, I Hate You, Charlie, I Love You, Charlie, personalizes the technology that keeps her daughter alive. This is an excerpt from her essay. Let me tell you about Charlie. Charlie drives me mad. He's always there like that third wheel who never gets the hint. Whether we're shopping, on vacation, or out to dinner, Charlie is there, hanging on us and making his presence known to everyone who passes by. He even rests under my pillow at night, whirring away while we all sleep. I should be used to him by now, but I still find him annoying. He could be described as a stage 4 clinger if he wasn't a machine. Charlie is my daughter Joy's feeding pump. Joy, now 3 years old, had surgery to sew a feeding tube into her stomach when she was still an infant because she can't swallow properly and has a hypersensitive stomach. At first, Joy would tug on Charlie, curious about this new object within her reach. She quickly learned, though, that each innocent tug hurt, and now she barely touches the tube at all. It's an accepted appendage to her. If she could talk, she would probably ask me why I don't have a Charlie also. My husband and I started calling the pump Charlie shortly after Joy and he were fastened together, and the name stuck. There was no reasoning or rationale behind the name. Much like Joy's doctors still have no reasoning or rationale as to why she has trouble swallowing or why her stomach often goes on strike without warning. Joy can only tolerate minuscule amounts of formula per hour for most of the day and throughout the night. Without Charlie, Joy would slide right off the growth chart and into oblivion. I hate that Joy needs Charlie to live, literally. This thought often keeps me awake into the wee hours of the morning, listening to Charlie humming along next to me. Still, I do a little happy dance in the doctor's office every time Joy gains another pound. Joy's feeding therapist has told us not to get too attached to the idea of Joy eating full meals. Maybe Joy will be able to enjoy a bite or two of pureed vegetables if she can coordinate her swallow enough at that particular time, she explained. She suggested we think of feeding therapy as a way to exercise Joy's mouth muscles. Still, I like to envision a time when my husband, Joy, and I are at the dinner table and she's scarfing down a big bowl of macaroni and cheese and then asks for more. I know that day may not come. Charlie may hang off the back of Joy's chair for parts of the day and keep her company in bed at night for years to come. We don't know when or if Charlie will ever get off our backs. I know Charlie is a necessity. If he weren't here, Joy wouldn't be either. And although to me, my daughter is perfection, Charlie symbolizes everything that no parent wants their child to endure. Even with the extra care and attention he requires, we love Charlie. We love that he gives us joy.
Joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn all about sarcoidosis, an autoimmune disease affecting many. Plus, we'll examine the controversy surrounding the new e-cigarettes. Are there hidden dangers? And we'll learn about the campaign to reduce the number of babies born to drug-dependent moms. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, all one word, .org. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.